get started and see what tonight's questions bring here. So, dear Ajahn, I wonder about the section on ethics, about developing right speech, gentle, pleasing to the ear, that goes to the heart, etc. How can it be explained then that there are examples of arahants like Mahakasapa who could still be quite sharp in their speech, causing hurt feelings like those of poor Venerable Ananda? To what extent is developing heart-going communication skills necessary for full awakening? As a matter of our own ethical development, is it enough to consider whether we had bad intention, e.g. anger, wishing to hurt other persons in speaking, and if we didn't, even if the other person got hurt, just not worry about it? Or is it part of developing compassion? Responsibly to take notice of how our way of speaking can hurt others, even if we didn't mean any harm, and make effort to change our way of speaking and develop better communication skills. Mahakasapa didn't seem to try too hard on this front, and still he was one of the greats. Thank you. Well, it's all, you know, it is all a matter of the most important things are obviously the other parts of the ethics. The most important thing is not to kill, not to steal, and these kind of things, and not to lie. These are the things that really matter, and that's why that is part of the five precepts. The idea of gentle speech is not actually in there, but the idea is to give you as many tools as possible to develop ethically, to give you as many kind of areas where you can actually change. Some people find some things easy to do, other people other things easy to do. Although it seems that the way that Mahakasapa may have been sometimes a bit kind of a tough character, it's very hard to judge these things just by reading the suttas. We don't really know exactly what was going on. Was he just being kind of forthright? Maybe he was being forthright, but still quite gentle. It's very hard to be absolutely sure what is going on there. But regardless of that, we just have to look at our own practice and see what we can do. And the more of these things that we can do in our life, the better off we're going to be. Yeah, so you avoid doing the bad side of things. And you're certainly careful about not being harsh intentionally. One of the interesting things about the path is that you have these three ideas of samma sankappa, of right aim. And one of those samma sankappas is the avihingsa sankappa. Avihingsa means being harmless, or being considerate, or being not being ruthless, right? In other words, you care about the outcome for other beings. This doesn't mean it's not the same thing as not having ill will, because ill will is a particular type of negative mindset. But this is just the lack of caring of the consequences of your actions on others. And that lack of caring, that coldness of heart, if you like, that callousness, that in itself is a negative thing in Buddhism. And the opposite of that is compassion. So you know, you care about these things. So you try to do as much of the positive as you can. Well, but the primary thing, of course, is to avoid the negative things. If you avoid the negative things, that's great. If you can develop some of the positive side of the virtue and ethics, then it's even better. So see what you can do. Do it in a focus on the most important things first of all. And if you find being very gentle in speech, if you find that difficult, and if you kind of just like to be forthright and say things in the right way, and that kind of the other things feels just doesn't work or whatever, then that's okay. Just do again. Do what you are able to do on this path, and see how things go from there. Okay, so let's see what happens. Actually, I'm supposed to do these ones here first of all. I forgot about these ones. Let's do these. This is the remainders from yesterday. Can you give some pointers on how to deal with self-hate? I'm constantly plagued with feelings of I'm not smart enough, not funny enough, not interesting enough, don't have a very interesting personality, etc. Okay. Okay, so how do you deal with that? Well, first of all, I think the problem here is that we are too concerned about what others think of us, right? We think that what other people think is really so important in life, and if we can't live up to other people's kind of expectations, then we are not really good enough or whatever. But other people, you know, they're just concerned about themselves. That's the reality. We are all most concerned about ourselves. Isn't that true? And it's some extent, this question is a little bit symptomatic of that as well. We really care most about ourselves. I don't think other people, probably, they don't worry about these things. You are more worried about this than other people are. So it doesn't matter. What far more important in the world than being smart or funny or interesting and all these kind of things, what really matters is the quality of your heart. If you are a good person, that is what really matters. And that is what actually, that is what people ultimately, if wise people meet you, they will praise you for being a good-hearted person, living your life well in a good way. If there are some scallywags out there that don't appreciate your kindness, who cares what those scallywags think? So don't worry about all of that. People who have opinions about this sort of stuff, usually they're not really worthy listening to in the first place. So just be a good-hearted person, and as you have a good heart and you live rightly, all of these kind of things will just evaporate after a while. You get to, you feel good about yourself. You get more self-esteem, so to speak, because of that goodness. You couldn't care less about what other people think anymore. And that's actually one of the liberating things on the Buddhist path, that you don't care so much what other people think. If other people have reasonable criticism and they say that you are not seeing yourself clearly and you should have a look at yourself, then okay, if the criticism is reasonable, then we can use that and maybe we can kind of improve from that. But a lot of the time, other people are just fault-finding and stupid, and it's not really worth listening to. And then we can just dismiss it and just keep on living our own life to the best of our own ability. And as you do this, as you live well, you start to feel good about yourself, and then the self-hate kind of disappears, right? Or the self-doubt or whatever it is, it starts to disappear. It's not there anymore, because you realize that you are doing so many things right. And by all means, do count your own blessings already now. The blessings in your life, the good things that you have going for you, the fact that you're coming here. I mean, that is astonishing, right? I mean, how many people come on this kind of retreat just to meditate, just to be peaceful, just to learn to be more kind and compassionate? It's an amazing thing. Just that intention, the fact that you want to do this, that in itself is an absolutely remarkable thing. That is what I always think about my fellow monastics and also the fellow lay people at the Buddha Society. What an amazing thing it is to be part of such a community here. And remember that you have already, that intention is a wonderful thing. You cannot change your personality. The personality is what you have inherited from the past. Can't do anything about that. That is kind of completely irrelevant. What is relevant is that now you are trying to live to the best of your ability, and you are already doing it in a wonderful way. Rejoice in that. It is marvelous. And then when you see the good qualities in yourself in this way, and you rejoice in that, that is where the happiness and the self-esteem and the self-worth and all of these things, they come from that ultimately. That is where it really comes from. Self-esteem doesn't come so much from worldly success. Worldly success is so difficult to measure and unreliable. Self-esteem comes from the quality of your character. Okay, good luck, and then see what happens. Dear Ajahn, I had not heard before that overeating can hinder meditation. Is that something you have read in the suttas, or have you run into that in the past? Okay, I think you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to realize that overeating can be a problem in your meditation practice. You get tired, right? You kind of don't really. It's much more hard if you kind of eat a light meal and afterwards you don't feel hardly tired at all. If you eat a lot, you got to sleep it off and all this kind of stuff afterwards. But yes, it does actually say that in the suttas as well. It says that moderation eating is one of the factors that takes you forward on the path. Yeah, so moderation eating is always a good thing. And yes, I also have a personal experience as well. Sometimes you just get it wrong, right? Sometimes you just can't seem to get it right and you eat too much or whatever. It's very rare that I eat too little. Either it's a little bit too much or it's kind of... So, and just feel it out for yourself. I'm sure you can figure that out. Just feel how your body reacts to these things and how it, especially how it affects your mind. You should be able to see that for yourself, I think. Yeah. Okay, how do you find a balance between the attachment to desires and apathy to achieve the happiness of letting go? I seem to be either chain watching TV or thinking this worldly life is pointless or has a lack of purpose. Okay, so the balance between attachment to desires and apathy here. Okay, so you just have to understand a little bit about where happiness lies in life, right? Where to find happiness. And it's not that hard to see where it lies. If you observe your mind carefully and see how your every action in your life, your every thought actually affects your mental state, whether you feel good or bad about yourself. It's really about having a bit of self-awareness. Of course, if you chain watch TV, then after a while you kind of become a bit numb. You can't really feel yourself anymore because you're kind of watching too much TV, and it's kind of you become a bit like a TV, right? You fill up your mind with all these programs inside. And so, but feel what feels right. Start to compare it to the Buddhist teachings and feel for yourself what is right. And after a while, when you start to understand where happiness lies, it's like you get a shift in your life and you start to find purpose and meaning in those areas instead. You understand where real meaning is. Real meaning is precisely the movement towards happiness, right? That's why you have desires in the first place. What are those desires about? They're all about fulfilling those desires. That's where they come from. They come from a sense of not feeling adequate, not feeling complete, not feeling fulfilled. So desires arise so as to feel more complete inside. But those ordinary desires, they can never fulfill that. They can never actually make you feel fulfilled inside. And then you move in a slightly different direction and you start to realize that those desires were lying to you, they were giving you a false promise. And that fulfillment that you are seeking is found instead on the spiritual path by practicing kindness and these kind of things. So just keep on this path. I mean, the fact that you are here is marvelous, right? It's wonderful. You must be pretty serious to be here. You're not a half-baked Buddhist at all if you come to this kind of retreat. You are a fully-baked Buddhist. That's what it is. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. So, congratulations. And you are already on the right track, already heading in the right direction and doing really well. So, feel good about that. And then, as you keep on reading the suttas, understanding what is going on, you will kind of be on the highway to more happiness. What a wonderful thing that is. Okay, so next one. Ajahn, why did the Buddha refer to himself as the Tathagata? I read that it means blessed. If so, I think it's humbling. The Buddha was himself blessed. Your explanation, please. I think it's humbling. The Buddha sees himself as blessed. Okay. It doesn't actually mean blessed. What it Tathagata means, it is a little bit of a mystical word. It can be understood in many ways. It can mean something like the one who has arrived at truth. Tata can mean like truth or reality. Gata is arrived. The one who has come to truth. That kind of makes sense, right? That sort of works well. Or it can be a bit more mystical. It can mean something like the one who has the one who is thus gone or thus arrived. That's a bit more mystical. So it's kind of, and the idea there, I think, is perhaps precisely that it is a little bit mystical, because somebody who has arrived at kind of the end of all suffering, at the highest happiness, you would expect a person like that to be a bit different from the ordinary person. So they are a bit mystical, right? So maybe the idea is to kind of give them a slightly mystical title. But the word Tathagata actually existed before the Buddha. It was a word that was used in India at that time, precisely of people who had practiced the spiritual path, that what was considered to have practiced the spiritual path to the long way. Of course, whether that really was the case or not, would have depended enormously on the person and the type of teaching, etc. But it was a pre-existing word anyway. So, and that is what it means. Blessed, the word blessed is usually a translation of Bhagava, the blessed one, right? But that probably means more like Lord in the sense of almost like a god or a high spiritual leader or something like that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, third and fourth foundation of mindfulness, please elaborate more on the mind in the mind, phenomena in the phenomena. Thank you. Okay, so we probably will be talking a bit more about the foundations of mindfulness later on. We are still only working on the sixth factor, which is right effort. The foundations of mindfulness, or the applications of mindfulness, are the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. So I haven't really reached there yet, but I'll give you an answer in brief, and maybe we can elaborate more on these things later on. So mind in the mind, this is chittanupassi. The word chitta does not mean just mind, it means a particular state of mind, a particular quality of mind. And if you look at how it is explained in the Satipatthana Sutta, it is precisely about the contemplation of particular qualities in the mind. So the way I would translate this is more like you contemplate one aspect of the mind. That is how I would translate this, one aspect of the mind. In other words, one aspect among all possible aspects. That's why it is a certain mind state among all possible qualities of mind. Yeah, that is how I understand that. So mind in the mind is kind of a bit weird, but as particular quality of mind is very easy to understand. You contemplate one quality of mind. That is how I would translate that, which is quite different from what you have here. So you're sitting down and you are seeing what's going on in your mind, right? You go through, maybe you watch the breath or whatever, and afterwards, after you come out of your breath meditation, you contemplate what was happening, just like I'm suggesting at the end of each meditation, but maybe a bit more thoroughly than that. It's pretty quick what we do here. And then you are contemplating the aspects of the mind. You learn about the hindrances. You see how they arise. What are the causes for the hindrances to arise? What is the mind without hindrances like? How is that affected? You see that and you understand it because you have been through that process yourself. And then you see, looking back, you see what was happening and how it works out. This is how you gain a degree of insight into how your mind works, the conditionality of the qualities of mind, and all these kind of things. But for it to really be powerful, you already have to have gone a long way on the path. Ideally, you have already gone past right effort to some degree, so the mindfulness is already well established, so that meditation is really quite strong, right? You're able to watch the breath and all of these kind of things. And that is where, when mindfulness starts to become strong, that is where insight into these refined things of the mind starts to become possible. And when you get insight into them, it enables you to abandon them and then go even deeper in the meditation practice. And that is the main purpose of Satipatthana, as far as I'm concerned, is to abandon the last remnant of the hindrances to take you all the way to samadhi. And the phenomena in the phenomena, this is the fourth part of the applications of mindfulness, dhammesu dhammanupassi, the contemplating of dhammas among dhammas. And the exact meaning of dhamma here is not entirely clear, And I think that what it probably means is that you are understanding, again, the laws of causality here. What causes certain hindrances? What causes the factors of awakening? How do they arise? Why do they arise? What are the conditions? How do they stay in place? How do they not decline again in the future? This is what you understand, the causality in the mind. It all sounds perhaps very kind of fancy and weird, perhaps. I don't know if you haven't, you know, if you're not really there yet, it may sound very kind of abstract, but actually it's very concrete. You're just looking at your own experience, and it's not that hard to see what is going on, as long as you keep at it and you do it for a while. Okay, maybe we can talk more about that later on, but that is kind of a preview of what is to come on later days. How do you know when you are ready to become a nun or a monk? Does your meditation need to reach a certain level? What are the right motivations? Yeah, you don't have to become an arahant first. You can do that later on. If you do, you have a problem. How you know you're ready? It is very hard to know these things. So the best thing to do is to come to the monastery, hang out for a while, and see what happens. Yeah, and sometimes we find out, actually, I'm not ready, I don't really want to be a monk at all. This is the last thing I want to do. Okay, go back into the world again or whatever it is. And sometimes you think, wow, this is really good. And then you kind of commit to this kind of lifestyle. People have very different reactions to the idea of becoming a monk and nun. And it's not that hard. You know, people think it is impossible, really difficult to be a monk and nun. But you get used to that lifestyle fairly quickly. It's not that difficult not to have dinner in the afternoon. Yeah. I mean, so you get used to that. It depends a little bit on the qualities you have, of course. And some people have, you know, have states of mind which makes it harder. But I think for most people, it is not that hard. The most important thing is that you have confidence in the Buddhist teachings. If you have confidence in that, if you read the suttas and you allow the suttas to inspire you, and you feel that there's something really wonderful going on here, that is going to carry you through almost anything here. And then you can deal with the problems as you go along here. Yeah, that is kind of, as far as I'm concerned, that is the most important requirement for being a monastic, is that a fairly good degree of confidence in these teachings. That is incredibly, incredibly helpful, because it will carry you through, as I said. Does the meditation need to reach a certain level? Not really. You don't really have to come to the monastery. Don't really have to have very, very good meditation or anything like that. The purpose of monasticism, in part, is to build up your meditation. So there's a great variety of degrees of meditation as a monk among the monastics. Some people incredibly good meditators, but many who are just kind of, you know, fairly ordinary in many ways. And kind of still trying to get there to, you know, to bliss out all of these kind of things. So the right motivation is just that you think, this is it, this is the meaning of life, this is what I have to do. Everything else kind of seems pointless compared to living the monastic life or living the Buddhist life. This is what I want to do with my life. You're just attracted towards it, that's good enough. You think it is meaningful, that's what really matters. And it is really great to be a monastic, I have to say. It is one of those, once you get used to it, it is astonishingly, there's so many wonderful things about it. The fact that you are in the presence of other people who practice like you. The fact that you sometimes are in the presence of very nice teachers who teach you in the right way. The fact that you have a nice cootie for yourself in the forest where you can just spend as much time as you want. Nobody in the world can do that. You can only do that as a monastic. Yeah. And all of these things, the kalyanamitta, the physical seclusion, and those two things in particular are very, very important things. And also the sense of kind of the fact that you're following the Buddha's teachings, the way he laid it down. Somebody was asking yesterday about becoming a bhikkhuni or instead becoming a meichi in Thailand. Actually there is, maybe I didn't kind of answer that question quite right, because there are some great advantages in being a bhikkhuni, in the sense that you feel that you are really a daughter of the Buddha. In the same thing as a monk, you are a son of the Buddha. You're practicing those teachings fully. You're part of a community in a way which follows all those rules and all the procedures, ordination, all of that that the Buddha laid down. And it makes you feel part of something much bigger. If you are a Meichi, you're always a little bit on the outside. Never feel that you're really part of it. And that, of course, is I think, a little bit, psychologically, it is a little bit of a problem. So being a bhikkhuni has a lot of good things going for it. So if you can find a place where they allow you to become a bhikkhuni, like Dhammasara Monastery or whatever, and you have enough access to the Buddha's teachings and to people, to other teachers or whatever, and you just have to try it out and see. But I was perhaps not clear enough the other day that actually there are some great benefits of being a full bhikkhu and a full bhikkhuni in terms of feeling part of that community, that you are dedicating yourself fully to the teachings of the Buddha. Just that perception and psychology, I think, is very important. And maybe the bhikkhunis would like to comment on that. I don't know if you would not want to say anything about that. Do you want to say anything about that, Venerable? Or don't have to do it today. Maybe do it. You can do it later on if you like. I think maybe at the end of the retreat or whatever. Sure. Yeah. So we can do maybe those things at the end of the retreat, and then we can have a bit more. Everybody can chime in a little bit about their experiences. Okay. So. Okay. Dear Ajahn, does ambition for spiritual advancement have a point beyond which it becomes unskillful, unhelpful, harmful? If so, how do we determine the point? Thank you, Emeta, for your words which go to the heart. Okay, that's good. So does ambition for spiritual advancement have a point beyond which it becomes unskillful and unhelpful? It probably does. You have to, the problem with, having too much ambition, often it kind of is often related also to having a lot of, desires and kind of cravings and all of these kind of things. If ambition is too strong, it might actually hinder you in your ability to become peaceful and to meditate and just allow things to be and just chill out and just kind of enjoy. One of the nice things for me about meditation is precisely doing nothing. You just sit there and you kind of allow things to become peaceful. And that is what is so nice. So it is about knowing, when to do things, when not to do things. It is important to have ambition always, to go all the way to the end of the path, but being skillful about how you apply that ambition in your practice. Not craving too much, not desiring, just understanding that there is something very vital to be done. And if you understand the vitality of it, the importance of it, it means that your mindfulness is always on the outlook for doing what is right. Yeah, and this is kind of one of the most important things on the path. The fact that you have enough mindfulness, enough memory of what is important, that in every moment of the day, you are giving yourself to doing the right thing. If you do that, if you remember that every little thing when you get it wrong, you're just subtracting from the path. You're letting yourself down. You're going in reverse mode, right? Going backwards. So instead of going backwards, there's always opportunity going forwards. Once you understand that at every opportunity, every moment you have an opportunity of going forward rather than going backwards, knowing that for your meditation to come together ultimately, you have to accumulate as much of these positive things as possible. You become on the outlook for that. You are careful, you watch yourself, and you realize the criticality, how critical this is. Then that mindfulness comes as a consequence. That is how the ambition should really work, understanding how important these things are. And it should be a different kind of ambition from the kind of worldly ambitions that we have. It comes about in a different way, through less craving, less desire. There's more wisdom related to it. So just again, remember, everything on the Buddhist path comes down to whether you are improving in the good qualities and declining in the bad ones. If you are generally improving in the good qualities and going down in the bad ones, especially over a span of a few months, right? You come back next year and you think, whoa, this year is better. This year I can, you know, I understand the difference. You know that you have practiced in the right way in between. So this is really, almost everything can be measured from that, whether you are improving or not in the good qualities and becoming, having less of the problems in life. Okay, dear Ajahn, what do you know, think is the rough percentage of monks who have attaining the jhanas in this monastery or generally? okay. Well, I think the jhanas are, I think people often misunderstand what the jhanas are. The jhanas are very profound attainments. It's actually very rare for anyone really, whether you're a lay person or monastic, to attain these states, because they are almost at the very end of the path. Right? When you talk about the jhanas, kind of next to the jhanas are all the attainments of the Aryan attainments, Sreemant and all of that. They are pretty much all at the same level. So once you get there, you're almost at the end of the path already. So it won't be that many, right? Certainly, even among those forest monastics who practice in the forest, it is not that common for these things to happen. Or it can take a long time of practice and training before you get there. But exact percentages, I'm not even going to kind of guess or to say anything about that, because it so depends on how you look at it, I suppose, how often you attain it, and all these kind of things, and whatever. But there certainly are monastics who attain it for sure, and there is a few, of course. But again, the numbers aren't that great because these are very profound things. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is samadhi? What's the difference between jhana and samadhi? Okay, samadhi is defined as the one-pointedness of mind or the unification of mind. Yeah, so it is when you are, or it can be defined as the undistractedness of mind. So if you are focusing on your breath and you're just staying with the breath, not going anywhere else, in an easy manner, not through force, not through willpower, this kind of thing, but naturally staying with the breath because you are enjoying hanging out with your own breath. Just enjoying that, staying with the breath. No distraction. That is already a kind of samadhi because you're not distracted from what you are doing. Even if you're just reading a book or something and you're fully one-pointed on the wonderful sutta that you're reading, whatever it is, and if you do that, then already it's a kind of samadhi that you're having. The real samadhi is the samadhi that comes as you, as the mind kind of becomes even more stilled, and the samadhi that comes just before jhana. But samadhi, usually in the suttas, it is equivalent to the jhanas. When you see the word samadhi without being qualified, it actually means jhana usually. Yeah, this is the real samadhi. And that's why it comes, that's why it's called samma samadhi, is equivalent to the four jhanas. So jhana is at particular states of samadhi. So you reach full samadhi and you kind of get locked in there for an hour or two or three or four or whatever it is. And that is when you know that the mind is completely one-pointed, no distraction, not going anywhere. In fact, it can't really go anywhere because you're kind of like you entered another realm where you are almost like you're frozen into that realm in a sense. These are the jhanas. These are the high states of samadhi that are the culmination of the Noble Eightfold Path. Do the monks do any exercise besides walking and daily chores? If not, how do you maintain your physical well-being, your fitness? Thank you. We don't maintain our physical well-being. Usually you do get enough by just working in the monastery, because the working in the monastery can sometimes be quite arduous. Sometimes we pour concrete and we do all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So if you do that, it can actually be quite arduous. Some monks do exercise. Some monks do yoga and that kind of thing. but not many monks go out for a jog. That's not very common. It's a bit awkward in these robes anyway to go jogging. Yeah. But it's not really required. You know, I don't think you really need that. We don't worry too much about those things. If you look at Ajahn Brahm, he's our example, so you get some idea, some idea that we're not too concerned. Okay, question number three. There is a stage where the mind is doing nothing. The breath is very little and the mind is not agitated. What do we don't do? What do we don't do? Is this the stage to wait? Is this the stage to wait? And how long for? Thank you. It's always about waiting, right? Every stage is a waiting stage. And this is why patience is one of the most important things on the Buddhist path. And the more you're just able to wait and sit back, and as I said, just nudge the mind a little bit, nudge it into the kind of right perception, the right ideas, and that little nudging can often be enough for the mind to kind of head in the right direction. Being patient is so important because things tend to calm down when you are patient and you just sit back and you're just aware. The reason why the mind is agitated and not peaceful is because you have been doing too many things in the first place. By withdrawing the willpower, withdrawing all the doing and allowing things to be, things tend to become peaceful by themselves. And then when the mindfulness gets reasonably strong, then you do watch the breath. But again, you watch the breath in a manner of complete passivity, just being aware, just watching the breath as if it's got nothing to do with you. You're just watching watching a bird flying by. You have no control over that bird. In the same way, your breath is this thing that you're just watching here. So if the mind is not doing anything, that's good, that's great, and you're just aware of the breath. And that is exactly right. Don't need to do anything. And you just keep on waiting. Hang out with the breath. See your breath as your friend, as your kalyanamitta on this path. You're walking into samadhi together with this wonderful friend of yours. This breath that has sustained you for so long, all these years. The breath has been your friend. Without your breath, you wouldn't be going very far. So look, get this positive attitude to whatever you're doing. And if you have this positive attitude, that is the sort of thing that will take you forward in your practice. Old friend breath. Wow, how wonderful to see you again. You're becoming clear now. What a wonderful thing. Just kind of move forward into this beautiful meditation together. Something like that, right? And then you kind of have a very positive view of things. Don't have to think those things, kind of just almost like you feel those things. And then you, hopefully, you're doing well. So that's good. You're doing well already, so keep on at it. Okay. Regarding what you said about euthanasia, according to Buddhist ethics, so it may not be bad karma to kill someone if it is done out of compassion. In such a situation, could one actually create bad karma by not killing the person, by pulling the plug, if they are in great pain? Again, it comes back to what your motivation is, right? If you think, hey, I will make them suffer, right, okay, I'm not going to pull the plug, ha ha. If you think like that, then... If you think like that, you're making bad karma, right? Because you are enjoying, you're being kind of enjoying the torturing of somebody else. So that is bad karma. So it is all about your motivation for doing things. But if you feel uncertain, you feel that, well, actually, I don't really know whether it's the right thing here. Maybe you feel unsure if the other person is in the right mind state. Maybe they are depressed. Maybe it is uncertain whether they might recover. Right? All of these uncertainties and things are good reasons to be careful. Yeah, so these are very sensitive and very places where you have to be careful. I'm just saying that as a principle, basic principle, it is not the act itself which is good or bad. It is the motivation behind the act that makes something good or bad. And this is such a very Buddhist outlook. You cannot divide the world up into good and bad acts. You can only divide the world up into good and bad motivations. So knowing where you're coming from is what really matters here. Perhaps one might be held back by the fear that any kind of killing, even so-called mercy killing, earns one bad karma, so you are afraid to do it. Is this just being selfish? Well, if you have doubts about your mind state, or you feel uncertain about this, or whatever, don't do it if you feel uncertain. If you feel that this is, you know, maybe on the edge of what is acceptable for a Buddhist, please don't do it in that case. Only if you feel confident about yourself. If it feels right and you can't really see any problem and you have kind of looked at the patient and thought about this through and you feel you have clarity about it, if you are confused, don't do anything here. But if everything feels right, that is the only time really that you should be doing these kind of very unusual things, if you like, on the path. Or one may not be sure of one's motives are entirely pure, so would rather err on the side of caution and not act out of mixed motives. Is this a good idea? Sure, that is a very good idea. Meanwhile, the person continues to suffer. Yeah, so that's right. So, but you know, you have to feel confident about these things for your own peace of mind. You can't just do things and kind of just kind of override your feelings and what feels right. You have to be about, it's not just about the other person, it's about you as well. You have to find that balance where both people kind of are happy about what is going on. Yeah. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, could you please give us a description of what conditions arose to have planted the seed of Dhamma in you? Would be inspiring to us, thank you. What are the conditions that arose that planted the seed of Dhamma in me? well, I say, I think the reason why I am a Buddhist monk, and this is because I was a Buddhist monk in a past life. That's what I think. Because it kind of came naturally, it just happened. When I was young, I didn't really have any Buddhist friends. My family wasn't Buddhist. I didn't really know anything about these things. And it kind of just happened, kind of naturally, kind of moving gradually in that direction. And when I heard about Buddhist teachings, and I kind of thought it was very interesting, when I tried to meditate, it had some nice results. Everything kind of just slotted into place. And I find it very hard to understand this, apart from the fact that I was a Buddhist monk, maybe a Buddhist nun in a past life, yeah? Possibly, yeah. Who knows? I remember when I was 12 years old, I had this fantasy about living in the forest, in a hut by myself. Right? Where do these things come from? Where did that come from? And I think the only reasonable explanation must come from a past life. Otherwise, a 12-year-old having this kind of fantasy is kind of weird. So that is... Yeah, so many of those things. Of course, now, over time, it changes, and over time, you read the suttas, and you gain even more inspiration. And for me, the most powerful thing now is just simply that, as far as I'm concerned, this is the meaning of life. This is what it's all about. Everything else kind of fades by comparison. I can't see any real meaning in just living an ordinary life, having a family. I mean, it's nice to have a family, of course. I'm not going to say anything bad about that, but it kind of seems... You know, where is it going to go anywhere? I'm a monk now. This seems really, really meaningful. Having a family, sure, if you do it in the right way, you can make it meaningful. But those things that make it meaningful are precisely the spiritual things that you do when you are a monk anyway. Much better to be a monk. You can fulfill those spiritual things much more as a monastic than you can as a layperson, I believe. So these are the things that drive me forward now. Anyway. So that is a little bit about that. The next one. Dear Ajahn, I wonder if it is sometimes necessary to say unpleasant truths. For example, to point out that a work project has fallen behind schedule or is in danger of doing so, and certain actions are necessary to remedy the situation. However, by doing so, it usually invariably will impact on others, or seen as laying blame on the person tasked to oversee that responsibility. In such cases, should one still go ahead to point out, raise the flag? Thank you for your advice. I think sometimes as a manager you have to, right? That's kind of the job of being a manager. And you have to point out things. And the Buddha specifically says in the sutta, as he, somewhere he says that sometimes you have to point things out to people that is unpleasant for them to hear, but it is beneficial for them in the long run to hear those things. And I guess as a manager, it is a similar kind of situation. I know it may be unpleasant for the person to hear what you have to say, but sometimes it is necessary to get the project going or whatever. And as long as you do it in a kind way, you do it with a mind of of a sense of compassion and understanding at the same time, then I don't think there is any problem there at all with pointing out such things. It's just necessary, just part of life. It's just the same thing in the monastery. We do a project, and if somebody does something really silly, you have to tell them, right? You can't do that. You're going to destroy the water supply to the monastery. We're going to go thirsty from now on if you do that. Oh, yeah, okay. Let's do it a different way here. So, these things are required. Sometimes you have to be upfront about things. So that is okay. Just make sure you do it in the right, in a good way, and then there is shouldn't be any problem there. Okay. So, a question for the nun seated next to the Buddha. Oh, okay. Okay. So this is a question. I guess it's not really urgent. Do you want to take questions at on the last day, Venerable? We want to take it now.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it's very burning. I think it's one of these questions. I can read it out if you like. In your kuti, what facilities do you have? Do you have aircon attached? Bath. What is your daily routine? So anyway, so it's not. I don't think it's urgent. Yeah. You want to do it now? Huh? Okay. You want to carry it over, Christina? Huh? Yeah. Okay.
Do you mean our kuti is at Dhammasara or the nun's cottage in Zanaku? Very different. So I think it's really funny when I hear Ajahn Ramani talking about how, you all coming here is like, it's a lot of renunciation and it's a lot less comfortable and that kind of thing. But for the nuns, they're like, wow, go to Java, go get here. It'll be like a bathroom. It'll be, running water. So it's actually quite different. The Sissies at Dhammasaya, we now have a bit, we have two kinds of accommodation since the new Sala complex has been finished. So for new trainees and some of the nuns who live in the accommodation pods, it's more like a regular room where you have electricity and you have, a bathroom not too far away, not in the room but close enough. But for people who live in the kutis, it's similar to a Bodhinyana where I'm not sure anymore about Bodhinyana, but I hear there are plans for electrification, but a Dhammasara is at the moment no electricity and water from a rain water tank, so it's quite simple. In the wintertime, some of the kutis, most of them have gas heaters, but it's not probably as warm as the heaters here. So in a way, it's not quite as comfortable. What are the facilities? Well, what the facilities, the important facility you have in the kuti, is you have a covered walking path, which is like a very amazing facility, which is something that I really treasure because it makes it possible to meditate, not only just sitting meditation, but also walking meditation, regardless of whether it's raining or not. And what other facilities do you have in your kuti? You might have a place to sit and a place a place to sleep, like a mattress. But that's basically you have a rod for your to put your robe, that's a facility. so pretty basic. But also kind of all you need really. So if you're interested, often during Katina time or the entry to the rains, we have a bushwalk where you're able to go and see one of the Kutis. So you can actually check it out if you're interested. And the daily routine is basically a little bit different from day to day. I don't know how detailed you want, but for most days, you have time in your kuti, and then breakfast is 6:30 in the main dining hall, and then work period after that until maybe dana time, which starts at 10:30, and then after the meal, you have a bit of bowl washing and chores, cleaning up kind of stuff, and then after that you're basically free to practice. The only variations are on certain days at Dhammasara. We have group practice, so Mondays and Fridays in the morning at 5 a.m. there's a group sitting, and on Wednesdays and Saturdays at 7:30 there's a bit of chanting and either listening to a Dhamma talk, recorded Dhamma talk, or on Saturdays just sitting together for about an hour. So there's a bit of group activity as well. And, sometimes we have a special occasion when Ajahn Brahmali comes over and he teaches us some stuff. So that happens maybe once every 1 or 2 months outside of Vata. And yeah, it's a pretty simple routine. So again, this is all something you can experience if you want to stay. You can come stay as a lay guest and take part in the routine. So I think that's all I have to say. If you have any further questions, you can write some more.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. So I guess, does it mean that we have a candidate for the Nuns Monastery here somewhere? Hiding away? Getting ready. Okay, so that's good. So there you are. That's pretty, very close, very similar to Bodhidharma Monastery in many ways, actually. Yeah. So that's great. Okay, so I'll take a couple of more questions, and then we will call it a day. So, dear Ajahn Brahmali, during meditation, after all the thoughts settle down, the mind is quiet. When such happens, do we bring up experiences and relate it to the three characteristics of existence or the Four Noble Truths, etc.? No, not yet. It is not enough. You need to be even more quiet. Just because the mind is quiet doesn't mean that you have yet reached a very deep state of samatha or samadhi. You want to take this much deeper than that. It's a good start. You're already doing well. The mind is peaceful. But you want the mind to become really powerful, right? You want to build up happiness and bliss in the mind. You want the mind to come together in a very strong way. You can, when it becomes quiet, you start off by watching the breath, and you keep on watching the breath until you become very, very solid in that samadhi. Yeah, this is the idea. So no need to really think about the Four Noble Truths and the Three Characteristics yet. What you want to do at this stage is to figure out those things that hinder you in your meditation practice. What are the problems that stop you from going even deeper? That is what is important at this particular stage. And then, so that is the kind of insight you're interested in, insight into your own mind, so that you know what you have to do to achieve that samadhi and that samatha as far as you possibly can. Then eventually, when that samadhi becomes very deep, then you have kind of got rid of all the hindrances, etc., that is when you really go into the Four Noble Truths and the Three Characteristics, etc. You have to get the... There is insight all the way along the path. Insight is an important thing, or vipassana is important all the way. But the areas where we have vipassana will vary depending on how deep our meditation is. So the idea is, first of all, to have vipassana, to have clear seeing into our own defilements, right? To understand how our own mind works. That is the initial thing. And ultimately, you have a big vipassana, big insight, big panya into the three characteristics. Everything, your entire mind, the whole world, your entire experience. That goes is further down the path. So, okay, so I hope that makes sense. What to do to direct the mind towards understanding the Buddha's teachings. I sit and sit when there is no thoughts and then fall asleep. So, okay, thank you for your advice, Ajahn Brahmali. Okay, well, So it means, if you fall asleep, it means you haven't got enough energy yet in the mind. It's great that you become peaceful and calm, but you need more energy in there. You need more joy. You need more happiness. You need to bring in these more of the, you know, the joy of just being here, the happiness of being in this place, bringing up some of your past experiencing, building up your sila, building up your goodness in your character to the point when you just feel naturally happy whenever you sit down. You feel good about yourself. Then when you close your eyes, you watch the breath, the whole thing just swoosh, takes off. Yeah. And that is kind of the idea behind this. So you need more energy in the mind. A mind without energy is not a mind which is going to penetrate very deeply into the nature of reality. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for the wonderful retreat. I am learning so much. Much love to Bianca and company, I think that's what it says, for their work and making this such a conducive environment for Dhamma practice. I'm in a loving relationship, and for a great relationship to flourish, there needs to be sexual intimacy. How does one further the practice along the Eightfold Path and still take care of business with with much love and metta? It's okay. It's not really a problem. You can live an ordinary life, ordinary relationship, and still practice the path, right? You just do what it takes, and then occasionally you come to retreats like this, and then you step out of that relationship for a while, and then you go back again, and then you compare notes, and just allow things to develop naturally. You live your life in whatever is required from that particular lifestyle. And as you do things, as you practice the Noble Eightfold Path, as you live that relationship, things tend to work out one way or another. But it's a gradual thing. It's not something you need to worry about. It happens by itself. It feels natural. Everything should feel natural what you do. And when it feels natural, then it's easy to do. So don't worry too much about where this is heading or whether you're going to be a celibate. Oh, I'm afraid of celibacy because the relationship I have is so good and all this kind of stuff. Don't even think like that, because these things should really happen completely naturally of their own. And then it's okay. So it's always been the case that people have combined an ordinary life with the spiritual life. That has happened since the time of the Buddha. And that is what you can still do in the present day, at least to some extent. And then see where that takes you. And don't be too concerned about those things. Okay. Dear Ajahn, nowadays, through the internet, we can often see nice words, quotations, teachings claimed to be from the Buddha. That's exactly right. Claimed is the important word there. Claimed to be from the Buddha Dhamma. It is tempting to spread these nice words, quotations to friends. The problem is, it is not easy to verify that they are from the true Buddha. What can be done about this? Especially the five Nikayas are expensive and not readily available. Okay, but they're not that expensive. It depends what you, I guess, what you prioritize in life. It is true. And actually, there is a website called Fake Buddha Quotes. And this website, they analyze all the quotes out there and they tell you whether it is fake or true. So go to the fake Buddha Quotes website and check out the quote that you have and see if it is real or not. If you have any doubts, you can come to me. I can usually tell you whether something is fake or not. Sometimes I might get it wrong, but usually I can tell you. I remember we had in the office in our monastery, we are supposed to be a monastery where you have the real Buddhist teachings, right? And in the office in the monastery, we had this calendar and had beautiful pictures of Buddhist sites and Buddha statues and all of these kind of things. And it always had a Buddha quote at the bottom, some kind of quote, and then the Buddha underneath. And not a single one of those was genuine. It was all fake Buddha quotes, right? And that is what the world is like usually these days. But you can discover a lot by going to the fake Buddha quote site. So go there and check it out. The fellow who runs that site, he's got his quite very well together. So you can trust what is being said at that site. Lay people like us is very difficult to find, and whether they are the original, also whether they are interpreted correctly. Thank you very much. So there you are. You've got a couple of pointers there to guide you. Maybe. Yeah. Sorry?
It's a good party game.
It's a good party game, isn't it? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good, yeah. Well, Ajahn Brahm loves that kind of games. Tell Ajahn Brahm. New Year's Eve at Dhammaloka is kind of games night, yeah. So, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Indeed, yeah. Okay, one last question for the night. Dear Ajahn, thus far my meditation experience has been essentially based on sight, i.e. what I see with my eyes closed, increasingly clear, bright, luminous, with both depth and wide expanse. As I reach this stage, the sounds of silence I hear becomes increasingly less. Last night and this morning, my sense of smell seemed to be very strong as well. I seem to be able to discern a range of smells around me. Is this normal? I'm also noticing that after the session, the effect of better eyesight seems to linger on. I believe I can be more with clarity, even to minute details. Please advise. And that is exactly right. So if this is what is happening, it probably is a very good sign, because your senses are kind of becoming sharper. You are more aware of what is going on. It means your mindfulness is becoming stronger. That is really what it means. And so that is usually a very good sign that you're becoming more clear about things. As long as you feel good about it and you feel kind of clarity inside, you don't feel any negative kind of emotions inside of you, this is usually a very good sign. You may have heard the story Ajahn Brahm always tells when he was a young man and he went to a meditation retreat in England. It must be over 40 years ago now. And he said after the retreat, he went into the garden and he saw this flower. And he was sitting on the bench staring at this flower for an hour or so. And he was a bit worried that people might thought he had gone completely nuts because he was just sitting there staring at this flower. But it's because your ability to appreciate the simple things and just see things in a new way is just so powerful if your meditation is going well. Yeah, and this is you. So you see the world in a new way, more powerful. Everything is more beautiful. Colors are more clear. Everything is nicer. And that is part of that. It says in one of the suttas somewhere that if you gain a deep samadhi like the jhanas and that sort of thing, when you come out from those jhana afterwards, then your food, even if it is just very simple food that you have, it tastes like the food of kings, right? The kind of ambrosia of the gods. Everything is so beautiful, even if it's just plain porridge or whatever it is. And everything gets this heightened quality to it when your meditation is going well. So that is great. That's wonderful. You seem to be doing really well in your practice there. What a great thing that is. So that is all for tonight. So have a nice rest tonight, have a good night's sleep, and then we'll see you again here tomorrow morning. Let's do the Arahang Sammasambuddha together here.